We have to. Here we are in these glamorous rehearsal rooms.
Yes,
of course. You really know you've made it when you arrive here, Corinne, don't you?
It's true.
And just for the sake of listeners, there's a fire door immediately outside which keeps banging as people go through, but that's life in the theatre.
Exactly.
It really is. So, Corinne, social networking has been generating a certain amount of buzz around this show.
Yes.
And I saw a tweet from its leading lady saying that she was squirreling a mint into her bra before
everyone saw that, didn't they?
Everybody saw that. I guess it's not the kind of number you sing with the mint still in your mouth.
Of course. Dispose of it early on.
So tell me, what have you been working on today?
Today we are doing the first picture, which is Act 1, Scene 1 with the chorus, and the third picture, which is the gambling scene.
Right.
And they are the two big chorus numbers.
Now, you use the word picture.
Mm-hmm.
So this gives a little bit of a clue as to what the concept of the staging is. Peter Konvichny's staging, which is being played without an interval.
Yes.
With a reputed running time of under 2 hours.
This is true.
So, first question, what's been cut? Hopefully that awful ballet from the gambling scene, or is that still in there?
Yes, that is cut. To go back to your first question, that which ties into this, we're going by pictures, meaning scenes, rather than acts, since there is no interval. So there are four pictures. The first picture is the whole first act. The second picture is the first half of the second act. The third picture is the second half of the second act, and then the fourth picture is Act 3. There are only actually a few things cut. Standard cuts, like one verse of A Forse Lui in the aria, which is pretty standard. The baritone cabaletta is cut, which is normal. Things like that. But the choruses are cut at the beginning of the gambling scene, so that's gone. And there are little lines here and there that don't really fit with the production, so they're cut as well. But for the most part, it's all there, and my role is pretty much all intact.
Isn't it interesting that we refer to all these things in the Italian because it's so hard to refer to them in English?
It's true.
And every time, even writing a review, I find it's really difficult. Sometimes you want to identify an aria, and the translation sounds so naff in print and doesn't really reflect what people know about that aria and how they connect with it. I mean, singing, you've sung the role before, haven't you?
Yes.
How many times? Just once? Or?
I did one production in Hong Kong before this, and that was my first one. And I have two more this season. So I have four total this season and one already for next season. So it's becoming a role that is a staple in my repertoire.
And this, the only one in English, presumably?
Yes.
How tricky is that when you've learnt the role in Italian?
It's difficult, not so much for linguistic reasons, because it is, you know, my language. Although the British English is slightly different than the way we would say things in America. So that was sort of a change. But English translations
also can be very arch, is the word I use. You know,
exactly.
I mean, words we don't use in conversational English that appear in opera libretti.
And the Italian is the same way. Sempre libera di Gio is not used in Italian nowadays. That's an old word. So it's still okay that there are old words in the English, but it takes some getting used to, I think, for English speakers.
Mm.
But the thing that's difficult is singing in English, because the Verdi said it so perfectly in Italian vocally, and it's such a vocally demanding role, that to really keep it as solid vocally with the English takes a lot of getting used to. But luckily, Iano has quite a long rehearsal process, so it gives me time to...
That helps. I mean, it's a contemporary setting of the piece, I gather, which is what Verdi and his librettists always wanted, didn't they? It was the powers that be that insisted that there was some distance put between the time when it was performed and the period it was set, because it was so shocking at the time. I guess it's still shocking, the idea of the sex worker or the whatever term you want to use for a woman, escort.
Yeah, I mean, if I may be so blunt, Herr Konvichny has a really amazing saying that always resonates with me, and he says, it says something about Verdi that the whore gets the most beautiful music in the show. he doesn't care about society. He doesn't care about the fact that, these people have money and that the Baron supplies her with money, so he must be greater than her. He doesn't think that. And in fact, he had a similar affair in his own life that really made him connect personally with this libretto and this piece, which is why the music is so incredibly personal. But I do think that's true. I think that Verdi kind of wanted to show the disparity between the people who are supposed to be good because they have the money, they're a higher class, but they're completely broken. Yeah. And Violetta is a real human being and a real person, but she is just brushed off like she's worthless. Mm. And
yes.
I love that.
Yes, double standards as well.
The production highlights this, yeah.
That's really good. And I suppose there's also something else in the drama, and that is that in society still, families disapprove of who their loved one is going to marry or
yes.
the prospects. And I mean, whether or not it's something as dramatic as being a hooker, the fact remains that people still interfere
mm-hmm.
in two people's very personal relationship. And
yeah, the story is timeless, and I think when it is modernized, it completely works and doesn't change the crux of the piece. It's not like taking Tosca out of Rome, which doesn't work. But, you know, you can kind of put this piece in any period as long as the interpersonal relationships keep their integrity in the way that Verdi intended. I think that the piece can kind of work in many ways.
Does he specify the illness? Because I know that it's perfectly feasible still that she might develop tuberculosis, but of course it's curable now.
Yeah.
I've seen productions which don't specify what she has
mm-hmm.
as terms of what is he doing in that respect?
Well, my physical gestures are very similar to what tuberculosis would be, but I'm kind of, because it is modern, sort of taking it as maybe like a walking pneumonia type thing, something like that. But I think the symptoms are still similar, the coughing, the, you know, maybe she sees blood in her hand after she coughs kind of thing. So yeah, it could
mm-hmm.
be a multitude of things.
How do you and Peter Konvichny see her as a character?
Well, I alluded to it earlier, but his production revolves around, and this is why he wanted to make a cinematic production without interval, around Violetta starting as the only human, he calls it, the only human in the piece. And everyone else is just kind of in this broken society and really is just not in touch with their humanism. They're like, it's almost like they are, you know, robots just without a soul. And as the piece goes on, more people develop this. But he really kind of, that's how he sees her, that he loves the contradiction between her lifestyle and who she really is as a person. And that is, I think that's brought out in any good production, but it's really highlighted in this production.
Mm. And Alfredo, I mean, you know, he's, madly in love with her, but there is this moment in the gambling scene
mm-hmm.
Where, because she is being true to the wishes of the father and trying to distance herself from him and saying she doesn't love him, where he kind of loses it.
Yeah.
And treats her appallingly. God, men are easily taken in, aren't they?
Yeah, well, actually, Germont says that to me in our duet. So, it's true.
I mean, these things really are timeless. And is it a very physical staging? Is it a very...
Incredibly.
Still...
Incredibly.
Okay.
The beginning, not so much for me, but once I hit Sempre Libera, once I hit the aria to the end of the opera, it's incredibly physical. And another interesting point is that Konvichny wants the love between Violetta and Alfredo to be unequal, because he believes that Alfredo is like this naive boy who hasn't really been through a lot in his life and hasn't kind of been through the hard times that she has. So his love is just not as profound. He thinks he's that in love with her, but he can't possibly be that person. When she says, "Love me, Alfredo," you know, during the famous "Ama mi Alfredo" line, he doesn't even see that she's lying to him. And if he really understood the kind of love that she felt for him, he would know that. And you know, Herr Konvichny has really picked up on these things that I kind of never really saw as deeply, and I really, really like these touches.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Because it's just what I was saying a moment ago about
yeah.
how as a man does he not see it, and how does he react so appallingly
yeah.
to someone that he is so passionately in love with? It just suggests that he exists on a slightly more superficial level.
Exactly. And that's the crux of our piece, our version.
Yes, yeah. But I suppose the light is seen at the end when it's too late,
mm-hmm.
by all parties concerned, which is why the tragedy is so intense.
Exactly, that's why it's a true tragedy, because these people do kind of grow as people and become more human, but by the time they do, it's too late.
Now, does it sit well in your voice, Corinne? I mean, you graduated from the Philadelphia School of, am I right, of vocal arts?
Yes, the Academy, of Vocal Arts.
And you've accumulated a clutch of prizes over the years. Was it always, when you started to sing, was it always opera that you had your sights set on, or were you interested in other kinds of singing?
I was. I didn't grow up with classical music or opera. My father is an amateur rock musician. He's a lawyer, but does that on the side. I grew up with lots of music, and I was in choir all through school, but I knew I wanted to pursue music, but I didn't know in what capacity. So I started taking voice lessons, because in college in the States, you have to go to school for classical music.
Yeah.
So I started as a mezzo-soprano and singing cherubino and things like this.
Interesting.
And my voice wasn't really blooming in that area, and also I just didn't feel completely fulfilled. And then finally, a mentor kind of showed me the way and said, maybe you should sing this stuff, and mm-hmm. showed me La Boheme and Carmen and these arias. And then I said, oh, I think this is more me. And that's when I really fell in love with opera, because I found my actual repertoire.
It's interesting how a teacher or a mentor mm-hmm. can completely change the course of your life, your singing life. I mean,
it's true.
And so many voices don't find their true place.
Yeah.
Because they're badly advised.
And you're
singing soprano repertoire, lyric soprano repertoire with bells on.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the bel canto, pretty much that mm-hmm. kind of the romantic end of the bel canto repertoire.
Yes, it is.
So you could have been a rock chick at some point.
Yeah, almost went down that road.
Oh, your dad probably wishes you were.
Well, he loves what I'm doing, and honestly, I truly believe I belong in the opera world, and I think having a life before opera really gave me a lot to bring to it, and considering that the characters I play all kind of have to be hard on sleeve, it really requires a certain depth and a certain level of experience that I finally feel like I've lived enough to bring something to the table.
Mm. I've looked at some of the repertoire you sing, interesting things like And True Love in mm-hmm. The Rake's Progress, and I can see you as And True Love in The Rake's Progress. I mean, because physicality has become so important in opera these days,
yeah.
hasn't it? From the days when I, as a boy, went to see opera, it was a very different game, where people did just park and bark, as
exactly.
the Americans say.
Yes.
You can kind of forgive that for the truly great voices of mm-hmm. our time. But it no longer has its place, because opera is theatre.
Yes.
And what the sort of productions that ENO are fielding these days, the emphasis is very much on how exciting it is as theatre, and whether or not it's going to attract people who've never experienced opera before and give them a totally different insight into it, which
yes.
I think is really exciting.
Yeah, I think that's all true. Because I'm petite, I've kind of gone into the consumptive roles, if you will, or the kind of tragic heroines, because I don't necessarily have the stateliness of a Donna Anna or one of those, but maybe Mimi or Violetta or Micaela or Anne True Love. They fit my voice, and they also fit my size and my temperament. And I think if there's a Brunhilde voice out there, no one expects that person to be my size, because
yeah.
to have a voice
yeah.
of that breadth is just not possible.
Yeah.
But for my repertoire, I think it's definitely necessary to look the part, to look like as if you could have tuberculosis.
It really does help from an audience point of view, but again, you have to be the right singer for the role. I mean,
yes, first and foremost.
I've absolutely. Seen awful casting of people who, you know, look great, but actually can't quite deliver what the role requires. It's a big house, the Colosseum, isn't it?
Yes.
You move in there when next week, is it?
Yeah, in the next week.
And so have you been and seen anything since you've been here there, or Have you stood on the stage and actually sung into the auditorium yet?
Yes, I actually sang my audition for ENO on the stage.
Okay.
And I got to sing four arias in that audition, so I sang a lot on the stage, and it was, I actually loved the acoustic. Granted, it was an empty house with no orchestra, but we have plenty of rehearsals in there, so I think I'll be okay. Yeah.
You know, this theater was originally used for musicals.
Oh, wow.
In the days when they weren't mic'd at all. Can you imagine?
No.
I mean, the first London premiere of Guys and Dolls was at the Coliseum.
Wow.
So it's got a great history of being a musical theatre house, but only in latterly an opera house.
Wow.
So quite an interesting background.
It is an interesting history.
Technically, do you feel... You feel at home in the role of Violetta? Clearly, if you're going to sing it again and again and again. I mean, John McMurray, presumably, at your audition. Who was at the audition? Ed Gardner?
John Barry and John McMurray were there.
Yes.
And Martin Fitzpatrick played my audition as well. It really does fit like a glove. The first act is difficult for me, but...
Sempre Libera is...
It's difficult for most people.
The whole opera is in that...
Exactly, and I think it, you know, if you have someone like Natalie Dessay singing Traviata, I mean, act one will be a breeze for her, but maybe not the other acts. And there's always going to be a part that's more difficult, and for me it's act one. But I've sung it so much and really worked it into my voice, and my voice teacher is Diana Sobiero, who sang this role many times, and she really gave me some tips to say, okay, in a big stage, this is what you need to do to make this heard, or... This is how to make your coloratura faster, and that's really helped me build the role into my voice.
Because it's all about how the delivery works rather than the size of the voice always.
Yes.
And whether the coloratura means anything.
Exactly. And in this production, it surely does. We'll see.
And is he really working in that kind of detail? So
yes.
Saying, you know, what does this bit of decoration, what does it actually convey emotionally?
He has an incredible understanding of the music. I think I read online that his father was either a conductor or part of an orchestra.
He was a conductor.
Conductor.
Quite a famous one.
Yes.
Yes.
So I think he was raised with this type of knowledge. He actually said in rehearsal the other day, let's start at the Neapolitan sixth chord. And I thought, oh my God, I haven't thought about a Neapolitan sixth chord since theory class. But he knew this,
yeah.
And he knows the music so well. He knows what instrument is playing at what point, and it's brilliant.
Are we getting a kind of, well, you might call it a superfluous IE flat at the end of Sempre Libera?
Well, I did that in Hong Kong, but because there's no interval, I'm finding it wise to not.
I think that's very wise, but also I think it would... it becomes then a showpiece, doesn't it?
Exactly. I've struggled with this because the public likes hearing it, but also for my type of voice and also my interpretation of the character, I don't think it's necessary or even maybe the best choice. But I have done the aria a lot in competition, and in that context, of course, I've just, you know, kind of pulled out all stops and done anything that I could. But in the context of the show, I actually prefer it not. I don't think it's Lucia. I don't think that it's that type of expression. I think she's kind of more grounded and stating her values at this point. So I don't think that the E flat is necessary.
These top notes can sometimes be, I mean, they're sometimes optional, but they can be deceptive, misleading, and they can change the complexion of what we're actually seeing.
Yes.
And usually at the Royal Opera House, you'll have an interval after Sempre Libera.
Exactly.
They always have too many intervals anyway,
but yeah.
There'll be an interval, and there may even be a curtain call if it's a big diva.
Yeah, exactly.
And when I started going to opera, there were always curtain calls in
yes.
opera. In fact, amusingly, Birgit Nilsson, I saw her sing Turandot at the Opera House.
Amazing.
She took a curtain call at the end of Act One. She hasn't sung a note. I mean, isn't that fabulous?
I love it.
That is
fabulous.
That just doesn't happen anymore. But,
that is fabulous.
No, I think that's exciting. But, I mean, also, one of our singers, I don't know if you know Claire Rutter, a British singer.
Yes.
She sings a lot of the bel canto repertoire. And Claire did Aida for ENO. And the first time round, she wanted to sing a high E flat at the end of the triumphal scene, which of course has only ever been done, I think, by that famous pirated recording of Callas.
Yes.
And the conductor said, no, it's vulgar, it's not, you know. But when they revived it, I happened to be in the auditorium and I couldn't believe my ears because she actually did it.
Wow.
And so it can have that kind of visceral thrill, but it does become something else,
mm-hmm.
I think.
I agree.
Operas, there is that danger in opera. So where are we, where next? I mean, this is a big moment for you, Corinne.
Yes, it
is. It's a big house, a big, important city, a production that... I'm really keenly anticipating because it does sound as though, you know, and it, I think that the other thing about doing something in this concentrated way is that the audience has no opportunity then to kind of, you know, they are focused completely.
Yes, I agree. And I'm always torn between The Age of the Diva, which is just so exciting and interesting, of Tebaldi and Callas, but also kind of now the age of, like, real theater in the sense, I mean, Callas was obviously a true actress, but it was still in the context of, but I am a diva and I will bow here, or I will, you know, turn to the audience and sing right to them kind of thing. But now it is really, especially in productions like this and with up and coming young singers, about true theater. And I'm really, really excited to be part of a production that is such a theatrical showcase. Mm-hmm. It's not... The singing is really an expression of the theater and not the other way around. And I'm enjoying that because it's a change from a lot of things I've done.
Mm. And obviously your voice is developing all the time, but I mean, it's clear the definition of your repertoire is quite clear at the moment, but where are your sights at the moment? What roles are you now learning or thinking of learning? What does that say about where you're going to go?
My main staples probably for the next few years are Micaela and Carmen, Mimi and La Boheme, and Violetta. Mm. I might be trying a Faust in an upcoming season, so that's a possibility. Also, Desdemona and Otello are things that I've looked at, but I'm kind of pacing it, and at least for the next two seasons, I won't be singing them because I already have my schedule. In a future season, I have Magda and La Rondine coming up.
That would work,
and that fits very well. Yes. The kind of a more lyric Puccini is really where I like to sit, like
yes.
Liu, Magda, Mimi, things like this. So yes, and I would love to do Liu. That's and Manon Massenet.
Yes,
as well.
Those are all good. I would have thought the Faust, the Margarita, and Desdemona are two slightly weightier scenes. I think everybody thinks the love duet in Otello, but
mm-hmm.
they always forget about Act Three.
Yeah,
you know, that is really a hell of a thing.
It is,
it? And similarly with Faust, still being there for the trio at the end.
Yes, exactly.
So,
the thing I think about Otello is that it has this element of this ethereal nature, and the character has that same. Temperament, in the sense that it can really help keep the voice lined up. It's not one of the screamier Verdi roles.
Excellent. Well, can we expect further tweets? I'm now following you. So
oh, good.
I thought, well, it's the least I could do. Since.
Great. Yes, I love to tweet about what's going on because I really think the public should not only see the final product, but the process is most of where the fun happens and the excitement.
Yes.
So I would love to share that with the public.
Yes, and I think that's a whole new world out there for, these days. I mean, it's extraordinary how it's taken off, and particularly Twitter.
Yes.
Where there's a dialogue going on in the community, which
yes.
I think is, on the whole, pretty healthy.
It's great. I've actually, especially in the London Twitter scene, I've met a few people that I've kept in touch with, and actually met one of my followers and fans, and we've gone out to dinner and went to a show at Whitmore Hall when I got here. So it's lovely. I've made some great contacts
here.
That's
excellent.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, I really wish you well with it, and we're all excited to see it. And great.
Great. Fantastic. Thank you very much. Nice meeting you.